Once upon a time, before Tiger Woods, before Michael Jordan, or even Joe DiMaggio, America's biggest sports star was a horse, a smallish, crooked-legged horse named Seabiscuit. The public adored Seabiscuit and came from far and wide just to watch him race. But why? Was it just his winning record that impressed his fans, or was there something more to his widespread appeal? With us today to explore the world of horse racing in Depression-era America is Ms. Laura Hillenbrand, author of the bestseller Seabiscuit, an American legend, and I should say, soon to be a major motion picture. Good morning, Ms. Hillenbrand.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
What inspired you to undertake the biography of a horse, and especially this horse?
I had known the story of Seabiscuit, just the horse himself, since I was a little kid. I read a story named Come On, Seabiscuit, which was a lovely book. But I didn't know anything about the people. And in 1996, I was just going through some old racing history documents, and I came across some information about the trainer and the owner and the jockey. And I realized I was looking at what I believe is the greatest underdog story I know of, anyway, and I think in the history of sport. And it hit me right between the eyes. I had to do a book right away on this one.
And how do you see his career reflective of the period in which he ran?
He, in a way, one of the things I love about this story is that the union of people that handled this horse, the trainer and the owner and the jockey, reflected America at the time in a really interesting way. The trainer was a guy who'd spent 60 years out on the Mustang ranges, breaking Mustangs for the British in the Boer War, herding cattle, herding sheep. He was one of the old-style horsemen. He knew the ancient arts of horsemanship. He became completely obsolete in the 1930s because the automobile was taking over America. And one of the principal figures that brought that about was Charles Howard, the man who would own Seabiscuit. And one of the things I love about that is the balance between these two individuals. And this was going on throughout American society in the 1930s. The old world was dying off in the Depression, and a vigorous new America was springing up. And this is one of the things I love about the story.
How would you describe horse racing in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s?
Horse racing was absolutely huge in America in the 1930s. It was growing very rapidly. The only sport that was doing better at the time was baseball, but by 1940, baseball was in second, and horse racing was far and away the most popular spectator sport in America. It was something that most Americans went to a racetrack on a regular basis as entertainment, and it's a different world than it is today.
But there had been a time when racing had been in decline before this.
Racing, there was an enormous temperance and reform movement around the time of World War I and a little bit before it, and racing was banned in most states of America. It survived on little backwater racetracks, and that's a big part of my book, is these individuals came up in racing during that era. And it survived at little racetracks cut through hay fields in places like Butte, Montana, and it survived its way back little tracks in Mexico. And it wasn't until the Depression when state governments needed to raise money because they were just swamped with needy people that they reorganized horse racing again and taxed it very heavily.
What about the purses? How large were they in horse racing?
They were very large. To put it in perspective, the average American in the 1930s was earning a little less than $500 a year. Seabiscuit was a bargain basement racehorse purchased for $8,000. That was a very low price for a racehorse in that era. And it's because the purses were so high and racehorses were running quite frequently. A racehorse could earn many thousands of dollars in his career, and Seabiscuit ended up earning more than any horse in history.
And what about the jockeys? Could they earn a lot of money as well?
A very few of them could, but it's only really the very, very elite, the equivalent of the Michael Jordans of horse racing could do it. Most jockeys were absolutely destitute. They were essentially owned by trainers who could stake them in poker games and trade them for horses and sell them to each other, and they paid them almost nothing. Jockeys were essentially slaves in that era, and most of them, none of them actually had insurance. And it's a very dangerous sport, and it was a very hard life for riders then.
How did they maintain their weight?
all sorts of ways. Back in that era, racehorses were assigned to carry in races as little as 85 pounds, which meant a jockey had to weigh about 2 pounds less than that in order to carry a saddle and a helmet. And they had to do all sorts of strange things to themselves to lose weight. They would, anorexia and bulimia were epidemic. They used laxatives to extremes. They devised their own laxatives. And one of the really strange things they did was they would bury themselves in track manure pits, which, because they were fermenting, were very hot, and they would sweat off weight in them.
Were Seabiscuit's jockeys also this desperate?
Seabiscuit had two jockeys, Red Pollard and George Wolfe, and they kind of represented the opposite ends of the sport. Red Pollard was, other than with Seabiscuit, not a successful jockey at all, and he was destitute his whole career. Actually, when he arrived on the scene with Seabiscuit, he had been living in a horse stall for 12 years. He couldn't afford rent. George Wolfe, on the other hand, was, in my opinion, the greatest jockey who ever lived, and he could earn very good money, and he was one of the very few who lived quite well.
How was Seabiscuit discovered?
He was, interestingly, discovered separately by his owner and trainer on the East Coast in 1936 in the summer. The trainer discovered him first. He was standing by the track rail at Suffolk Downs in Boston. The horse went by him. Seabiscuit at that time was a terribly failed racehorse. He was at the absolute bottom of the sport. He walked by the trainer, and he stopped and looked at him. And the trainer liked something about the look in the horse's eye. The horse looked regal, and the regalness didn't fit the horse, who was a very ugly little animal and very unsuccessful. And the trainer kept him in his mind. He took note of the name, although I don't know that he remembered it later, but he remembered that body and he remembered that face. About a month later, Charles Howard, the owner, was sitting in the grandstand at Saratoga Race Course about to watch a very cheap race. He and his wife looked down at an ugly little horse going to the post in a very bad claiming race. And Howard liked the look of the horse, and he pointed him out to his wife, and his wife laughed and said, "I'll bet you that horse doesn't win," and Howard took the bet, and the horse won, and Mrs. Howard purchased her husband a lemonade as to settle the bet, and they sat there thinking about that horse, and they realized they wanted him, and they sent Tom Smith, the trainer, over to the barn, and he recognized the same horse he had seen at Suffolk Downs, and the purchase was made.
What was Seabiscuit like before he was found?
He was, as I said, he was a terrible racehorse. It took him 17 starts to win his first race. He could flounder at the bottom level of the sport. Occasionally he would uncork amazing speed, but he wasn't willing to show it. He was lazy. He was sort of a conniving little horse. He would try to avoid training. And he had a lot of emotional problems. He paced in his stall. He refused to eat. He was 200 pounds underweight. And he was physically very ugly to look at, very badly put together, unsoundly put together. But he had a tremendous will to win when his head was straightened out, and that's what Tom Smith, his trainer, set out to do.
And he had a fabulous pedigree as well.
He had, well, I wouldn't call it fabulous. He had Man O' War in his pedigree. Man O' War is probably the greatest racehorse who ever lived. He was his grandfather. But Seabiscuit's parents were difficult horses. His father was such a difficult animal, such a violent animal. He was eventually just retired because he was refusing to run. And he was such a bad sire, he never produced another good horse. He ended up in the Army Remount Service. His mother was so slow that they never bothered to race her at all. So he had good blood in him, but you have to go back a generation or two to get to it.
So how did he become competitive?
He always had that competitive will in mind. Almost all thoroughbreds have it. Racehorses have been bred for hundreds of years to be competitive. They love competition. The thing with Seabiscuit was he didn't like being forced to do anything, and his first trainer was forcing him. He was having riders use the whip very heavily on him. He was racing him on an appalling schedule, sometimes running him two or three times in a week, which is today horses rarely run more than once every 2 weeks and usually less often than that. And the horse was just getting sour, and he was getting difficult. And what he needed was a trainer who could help him rediscover how much he loved to run.
You talk about Seabiscuit having a will to win, wanting to run, being difficult. Isn't that anthropomorphizing a horse?
It's absolutely possible to anthropomorphize any animal, but it is equally possible to overlook the analogies between ourselves and them. And anybody who's been around horses and been intimate in horses' lives will tell you that they are very, very much like ourselves, and you can see the same kinds of behaviors in them, especially when they're on the racetrack. They're fighting through horse races, and they are trying very hard to win, and they will do the same kinds of taunting things, some of them, that human athletes will do, that Michael Jordan will do in a basketball game. And I spoke to a lot of the people that rode the horse, a lot of the people that were around, and they all swore that this horse, he wanted to win, and he would rub other horses' faces in it. He would get up alongside them and deliberately slow down and then burst away right at the finish wire. He would let horses get a little bit ahead of him, and then he would get ahead. He would snort in their faces and do all sorts of things like that.
How did Seabiscuit come to public attention? When did he build up such a following?
I think the thing that really turned the key for Seabiscuit, he turned around very quickly once he got in the hands of Tom Smith, and he began to win and win. The thing that brought him to the public's attention was he ran in the 1937 Santa Anita Handicap, which is a race that still exists. It, at the time, was the richest horse race in the world. It had a $100,000 winning purse, which is colossal money in those days. And it was one of the first big national radio events in America, and everybody tuned in. And this horse showed up at the 1937 Santa Anita Handicap. He did not win because of a mistake by his jockey, but he ran a valiant race, and he was immediately a huge, huge star.
And how much of a draw did he finally get to be?
He was, this is hard for people to believe, but he was, by newspaper column inches, the number one newsmaker in America in 1938. Roosevelt was second and Hitler was third. This is a documented thing. Newspapers used to keep these statistics. This is a horse that had ladies' hats named after him, that had, I found thus far, 9 parlor games in his image. People would crowd out by the radio, by the railway lines, and just to get a glimpse of him through the windows of the train when he would travel across America. He was an enormous star, and at the pinnacle of his career, when he faced his great rival, War Admiral, in a match race, 40 million people were listening on the radio. That's one in every 3 people in this country.
How did this rivalry with War Admiral develop?
War Admiral is the polar opposite of Seabiscuit. Seabiscuit, once he was in Tom Smith's hands, was a very sweet animal. You could blow up a bomb next to him and he wouldn't turn a hair. Very social horse. War Admiral came from the East. Seabiscuit came from the West. And War Admiral was great right out of the box. He won the 1937 Triple Crown. He absolutely dominated the world of racing, but he hadn't met Seabiscuit yet, and neither one of these horses could find a horse that was good enough to really run with them. And the whole country started dividing up in this rivalry, and they didn't meet until November 1st, 1938. It took 2 years to set up this match race and finally get it to go, and it was a huge affair in America when they met.
It's been called sometimes the greatest horse race ever run. Why?
It's the greatest horse race I've ever seen. I actually just watched a film of it again last night. For one thing, a great deal was riding on it, because it's very, very rare in any sport that you get 2 all-time great athletes appearing at the same time. And this happened with these 2 horses. They were only 1 year apart in age. And it was a time when America was kind of discovering the West, when the West was coming up economically and culturally in America, and Seabiscuit began to represent the West, and people in the West became fanatically devoted with him. People in the East became fanatically devoted to War Admiral, and so a lot rode on it that way. And then when they finally met on the track, the horses delivered. This horse race, I cried when I saw this race last night, and I have seen it dozens and dozens of times, but they went head and head around the track, and they really put on a show.
And did Seabiscuit ever win the Santa Anita Handicap?
I'm not going to give that away. He spent 4 years trying to win that race, and every possible thing got in the way of it, including a catastrophic injury to his leg and 2 catastrophic injuries to his jockey. But they did come back when the horse was quite old and go for it again in 1940, and I think he unleashed his best performance there, but I won't tell you what happened.
We'll leave our listeners in suspense.
Yes.
Okay. Most authors only dream of having a New York Times bestseller, and Seabiscuit was number one for weeks on end. Why do you think this book has appealed to so many people?
You know, when I wrote this book, I wanted a chance to tell the story, but I thought because it was about a racehorse and because it was about horse racing, that it wasn't going to draw a huge audience, that people wouldn't really give it a chance. And so I was very pleasantly surprised. 5 days after it came out, it hit the bestseller list, and it did go to number one. I think the reason it did is everybody's a sucker for an underdog. And this horse and the people around him were great underdogs, and the people around him are as much a part of the story as the horses. They were very, very compelling men, fascinating men, and people don't live lives like this very often. Each one of them had a life that was full of adventure and vigor and grace, and it makes it a very satisfying story.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, we have been talking with Ms. Laura Hillenbrand, author of Seabiscuit, An American Legend.